Case number 22-1018, Advanced Energy Economy et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Ms. Fidler for the petitioners, Mr. Kennedy for the respondent, Mr. Fitzgerald for the interveners.
Morning. Ms. Fidler? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, you are. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Danielle Fidler, and I'm here on behalf of petitioners. I'd like to reserve three minutes for rebuttal. Because this appeal involves so many claims and proceedings, we'd like to focus today on the three issues central to resolving all of them. First, like most agencies, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has straightforward rules on how to calculate statutory deadlines that expressly cover the required actions and time periods at issue. FERC's refusal to apply those rules to the request for a hearing of the deadlock order is unlawful and inequitable. Second, the court must correct the Commission's interpretation of Section 205G of the Federal Power Act to clarify that whether riding for a majority or a tie, the duty to provide a reasoned rationale and make findings of fact rests solely with the commissioners and not the court. The failure of the commissioners to meet that duty here was arbitrary and capricious. Finally, even if the court disagreed with these points, it must still vacate FERC's approval of the Southeast Energy Exchange Markets Transmission Service, which is an unduly discriminatory power pool. FERC's findings to the contrary abandon its duty to prevent monopoly utilities from using their market power to shut out competitors and overcharge customers. Turning to the first point, petitioners' requests for a hearing of the deadlock order were timely filed in accordance with FERC's rules for two reasons. First, the utility's requested effective date caused the end of Section 205D required minimum 60-day notice period to fall on a weekend or holiday.
But, by the way, if we agree with you about this, do we have to reach any of the tariff issues?
Yes, Your Honor, both.
Why? If the agreement's invalid, they're vacated, why do we have to reach the tariff issue? Aren't they all dependent on the agreement?
They are two separate filings, Your Honor.
Right, but would the tariff filings have occurred but for the agreement?
It's true, Your Honor, that they are, if the SEEM agreement were invalidated, that would certainly make it more difficult to have the tariff go into effect. But they are separate orders, Your Honor, I think both orders have to be
right, but,
addressed.
But let me make sure I understand. If we invalidate or vacate the agreement, send it back, do the tariffs cease to be effective? Do the tariffs play have any role at that point?
Well, because the tariffs are still the tariffs at issue, that is the tariff in effect right now, they also have to be, the order for that also has to be invalidated.
But I guess
I don't understand that.
But I guess you're to just see if I can understand your answer to Judge Tatel's question. You don't believe that invalidating, you know, assuming for the sake of argument that we agreed with any of the challenges to the SEEM agreement and in order of vacature, you don't believe that inexorable leads to vacature of tariff.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's correct. Our petitioners have pointed out these are two separate filings. While it would, as a practical matter, I'd be difficult to continue with a tariff if the SEEM agreement itself has been invalidated. As far as the operating tariffs are in effect currently with the Commission, both orders have to be invalidated as a practical matter. If referred back to the Commission, they have the authority to do what's necessary and may themselves decide to implicate the tariff order. But as far as the procedure stands, both filings are in effect.
If we agreed with you that the rehearing petition was timely, why shouldn't we remand to FERC to consider the rehearing petition of the mayor?
We've asked that it be that it be vacated and sent back to.
No, I understand that's what you've asked for, but why wouldn't the prudent thing to do be to remand for FERC to consider on the merits? I mean, we took a similar approach in a case called Dayton Power and Light, where the rehearing petition, FERC found it was untimely, the court thought it was timely, and then we remanded for FERC to consider it on the merits. Because that's the whole purpose of rehearing, you know, in this scheme, is to let the agency have an opportunity to consider these arguments on the merits in the first instance.
Correct, Your Honor. And I'm sorry, could you just restate your question with regard to that? I apologize.
So I'm saying, why, if we agreed with you that the petition was timely, mm-hmm. why wouldn't the appropriate remedy be simply to remand to FERC to consider the rehearing arguments on the merits?
Well, two things, Your Honor. There are factual errors in the agreement itself that the commission has adopted as part of the rationale, one of them being that the agreement is bilateral. And the agreement
but
itself...
Those things could be considered on rehearing by FERC in the first instance.
Correct, Your Honor. And yes, remand is appropriate for the commission to reconsider the agreement on the merits, Your Honor. I would posit that the tariff order has already addressed many of the commission's findings with that regard. And that's why, again, we ask that both orders be considered by the court, because many of the findings regarding the agreement, some of the core principles are before the court in the tariff order, specifically with regard to questions, for example, whether or not this is an unduly discriminatory power pool. So I think just sending the agreement back would leave in place or send commission back without direction on those substantive issues, which are properly before the court and are also based on error, Your Honor.
If the agreement's invalidated, say why there's an illegal power pool.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
Why? If the agreement is invalidated, why is there a power pool, an illegal power pool? I'm missing that. Isn't the illegality of the power pool tied up in the agreement?
It is, Your Honor. I guess, at least my understanding of Judge Rao's question was if one was sending the agreement back for reconsideration by the commission, as the first order of business, the concern that petitioners have is that the commission's findings with regard to that question, Your Honor, about whether or not this is a power pool, are before the court now with regard to the tariff order. So I think, so petitioners argue that decision is also arbitrary and capricious, and that information needs to be provided to the commission as it considers both the agreement and the tariff. And additionally, with regard to the agreement, without further correction from the court regarding how to handle a deadlock order and the requirements of arbitrary and capricious review, given that the commission is once again at four members, that instruction from the court is important to inform the court both of how to handle the review and also that the issues with regard to the substance of whether or not the power pool is unduly discriminatory also need to be provided as they reconsider the matter.
Did I just hear you say that the commission is still at four members?
It is back to four members, Your Honor, yes.
Are they the same four members that considered the... I guess the SEEM agreement in mid 2021.
They are not, Your Honor. Chair Glick is no longer on the commission, and Chair Phillips is now.
So, getting to the merits, assuming we find that. The challenge, the request for rehearing was timely, and and that we have jurisdiction over the challenge to the seaman. Help me understand, I guess, with respect to the, and let's assume also, just for the sake of this question, that we agree with kind of how your construct of how we're supposed to review the deadlock. Help me understand why there was a failure to respond to the governance and membership structure and independence of senior leadership, some of those other points that you say you raised.
Oh, with regard to the agreement?
Yes.
Your Honor, with regard to the agreement, while we discussed this in great detail, I think some of the fundamental issues are that the findings as to whether or not many of these provisions, including governance, monitoring, and other requirements on the SEAM agreement are permitted, rest on the finding of the supporting commissioners that this is a bilateral agreement. But this is not a bilateral agreement. At each turn, the elements of the agreement that come up in terms of the whether or not this is a power pool, whether or not the terms are discriminatory, for example, the enabling agreements not being mandatory, basically the unfettered discretion to allow people to participate. At each turn, supporting commissioners rely on, but this is just an extension of a bilateral market. But this is not bilateral. And FERC's own fundamental documents reflect that a bilateral agreement is, by definition, two parties that know each other, that set the terms and set the price. This is not that case. This is many parties, as they admit, that's across 10 states and two time zones. The bids and offers go through an algorithm that does the matching. There must be a minimum of three parties every time one bids. So by definition, this is a multilateral agreement. And so to the extent that the supporting commissioners were relying on the characterization of the agreement as bilateral, that's just erroneous and has to be corrected. Furthermore, the supporting commissioners relied on set up a sort of straw man argument that petitioners were motivated, somehow improperly motivated by seeking an RTO in their objections. And that was, A, not factual, but also then caused, then the commissioners didn't address a specific language in Order 888, in the rules themselves, that were contrary to the commissioners, the supporting commissioners' positions. That's with regard to the SEAM agreement. With regard to the tariff order, let me just pause there, Your Honor. Did you want to focus specifically on the agreement at this point, or also the tariff order?
Well, if there are no other questions about the agreement from my colleagues, then I guess if you could say something about the application of the Mobile Sierra.
Yes, Your Honor. At core, one of the fundamental problems with application of Mobile Sierra is, again, Commissioner Danley determines that his basis for this is that he specifically proposes that the Mobile Sierra presumption apply to all tariffs. He notes that his position goes against precedent. And Commissioner Christie, again, specifically relies on this being a bilateral agreement. So Commissioner Christie's view is that it's appropriate to apply a Mobile Sierra presumption to a bilateral agreement. But obviously, when there's not a bilateral agreement, then that presumption does not automatically apply. And what the commission's extensive precedent says is that there at the very least has to be a balancing analysis of provisions that are not generally applicable versus those that are more contract provisions. in the record in this case, that balancing analysis was never conducted in the first instance. So there was no record upon which the commissioners could rely to determine that Mobile Sierra presumption should be applied.
I do have some questions about jurisdiction under A24DG. So just looking at the plain language of this provision, what is it about this statute, just looking at the text, not the legislative history, that gives us jurisdiction to review the deadlock order itself?
Yes, Your Honor, when read together, Section 205G and Section 313 require deadlock orders to be reviewed on the merits based on the supporting statements. And that has to do with when taking 205G1's language, it specifically determines that if the 60-day period under 205D, the notice period expires, then under A, the failure to issue an order accepting or denying the change by the commission shall be considered to be an order issued by the commission.
It shall be considered an order for the purpose of rehearing.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's because what the court is reviewing is determined upon what is brought up in the requests. Sorry, what the court is reviewing on judicial review under 313B is determined by what is brought up by petitioners in 313A. So in order to have something to review, the requesting parties have to respond to the commission's decision. If there is no order, if you're still just at the record, then what would come before the court is the entire record, and there would be no agency decision. And that really goes against the structure, the construct here that there is a commission order to be reviewed and that there is to be the written statements as part of that record. So the way they work together is that statement, the written statements are what the parties are responding to in under 313A and the request for rehearing.
I'm not sure that anything in G changes our case law under Public Citizen or the two FCC cases that Public Citizen relies upon. I mean, this order takes effect by operation of law, which means there isn't any commission decision. And the statute says that each commissioner separately, right, is adding to the record their statements. But I don't think that changes any of the reasoning of those underlying cases, that there's nothing for us to review.
Respectfully, Your Honor, 205G was a direct response to the court's
That's what the legislative history says. But what is the text that Congress actually enacted? It doesn't seem to get around the problems in our case law.
Well, Your Honor, it's not that there's nothing to review. The language specifically states that this shall now be considered an order of the commission and directs
that
order
of rehearing. And then the only thing that's judicially reviewable under G is if there is a deadlocked rehearing order. That becomes judicially reviewable. But we don't have a deadlocked rehearing order here. Here we have a rehearing order that focused on timeliness.
But Your Honor, it goes on to say, 205G goes on to say in 205G2, that an appeal is pursuant to the subsection, a person seeking rehearing under 825LA, and the commission fails to act on the merits of the rehearing request by that date, because the commissioners are divided two against two, such a person may appeal under
yes,
two.
Yes, but we don't have that circumstance under two. That circumstance hasn't obtained in this case. There wasn't a deadlocked rehearing decision.
For the acceptance, there was
a deadlocked initial order, but there was not a deadlocked rehearing order, which is what two is talking about.
Well, in that case, if the rehearing was denied by operation of law,
but it wasn't denied by operation of law in this case. The commission voted 3-1 on rehearing that the rehearing petition was not timely.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, but the rationale for that again relies on the initial deadlocked order.
Where in the statute does it rely on that?
No, the rationale of the timeliness decision is I mean, the at this point, that's a review of the timeliness order and not of the deadlock order itself, Your Honor. I mean, that order.
So the deadlock order is not. We don't have jurisdiction over the deadlock order. Nothing in G gives us jurisdiction over the deadlock order.
Your Honor, well, in that, I mean, we have appealed the request, the denial of the request for hearing on timeliness. And at this point, the rationale for review. So if the court has determined that the timeliness order was incorrect, then it's still back at the decision with regard, that's a deadlock order. And Your Honor, a petitioner would argue that still should be reviewed, especially since it's being sent, if it were to be sent back to the commission, it would still be reviewable under 205G and that guidance should be provided on what the commissioner should be, the standard of review that would apply.
Not sure I understood your response. I mean, I think that, as I understand Judge Rao's question, it is that, I guess, dovetailing with her earlier question about date and power and light, is that if the what we have jurisdiction over is the denial of your rehearing, the relief you request in the rehearing, by the rehearing, and if that rehearing order was erroneous, assuming we agree with you on how to interpret the statute's timing jurisdictional provision, then why isn't the proper relief to send it back and have them evaluate your rehearing request on the merit and leave it at that?
Well, Your Honors, and I just know that I am out of time.
That's fine. We'll let you know when you're done.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, that is correct. Posturally, that is the correct relief for the acceptance order. However, as we've noted, the same issues are involved in the tariff order. And the tariff order is properly before the court, and we have asked for relief of the tariff order, and the commission is also already relying on the acceptance order's rationale for further the amended agreement rationale. So again, Your Honors, I would petitioners would posit that the court has before it the tariff order as well, and that would need to be addressed at the same time.
But it seems like some of the rationale for approving the tariff order was, look, if the SEEM agreement is going to be in place, then in order for it to work properly and to implement it, some of these provisions of the tariff have to be effective, like the toggle feature and other things. And so it seems like and that explains why, there was a deadlock on the agreement, but 3-1 on the tariff order, because it seems like at that point the consideration of the tariff order was affected by the fact that a SEEM agreement was and so I guess what I'm trying to understand is why wouldn't the best thing to do would be to essentially vacate the tariff and send this back to FERC to properly consider all of the items that were raised on rehearing and then go from there, that if it results in them also again approving the SEEM agreement, and that's what it results in, and if that results in them approving the exact same tariff order, that's what it results in, and then if need be, then you come back to this court.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the third vote for the tariff was specifically because Chair Glick disagreed with the issue of mobile tariff coverage. But the tariff order specifically deals with the merits of the questions of the toggle feature, the enabling agreements, basically the participation elements, and finds and addresses those on the merits very clearly. The reliance, there's not a direct reliance in the tariff order on the acceptance order. There is a similar logic underlying some of the approval of some of the elements in the tariff order on the same nature, on the same erroneous characterization of the agreement as bilateral. But the commission very specifically addresses the merits on the tariff order and addresses them in substance with the understanding that they were separate. And Commissioner Clements raises these points in her dissent on this. I would also just remind Your Honor that the market is now up and the injury to petitioners is continuing. As the market is continuing in a way that's giving monopoly utilities a competitive advantage, that advantage continues while the matter is being reconsidered. So because the commission has made independent findings on the merits with regard to the tariff order, it's critically important to address those merits while they're here before the court.
So Ms. Fidler, so on your view that these two orders are independent, then it would be fine for us to remand the rehearing order on the deadlock SEEM agreement, but uphold the tariff order. I mean, I know that's not the relief you're seeking, but you're suggesting that they are analytically independent. So the fact that we are remanding the SEEM agreement doesn't mean that we would have to necessarily vacate and remand the tariff agreement.
Procedurally, Your Honor, that is correct.
Thank you.
Your Honors, are there
any other questions, Judge Tatel?
No.
Judge Rao?
Yeah.
We'll give you some time on it.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Kennedy?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. We'll hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please support him, Robert Kennedy, on behalf of the commission. I guess I'll take the hint and start with the timing issue. A unanimous commission found that petitioner's rehearing requests were untimely, and they did so by interpreting the notice period in Section 205D in exactly the way this court said it should be interpreted in Indiana and Michigan. That is, as a maximum waiting period that can be imposed on utilities. And this flows from the structure of the Act. As the Supreme Court said in Memphis Light, which was discussed in the Commission's tariff rehearing order, except this, and Memphis Light discussed Section 4 of the NGA, the corollary of Section 205 of the FPA. The court said, except as specifically limited by the Act, the rate-making authority of utilities is just the same as it is of sellers of a non-regulated commodity. Now, one of the specific limitations in the Act is this 60-day notice period. But because the statute leaves the utilities' rate-making authority undisturbed, except as specifically provided, the Supreme Court said that the notice period, that the sort of the embargo and rate changes imposed by the Act must be interpreted in a way that allows for the earliest effectuation of rate changes. And that's what the commission did here when it said 60 days means 60 days.
How is that consistent with FERC's own rule 2007?
Well, I think I have a couple of responses to that, Your Honor.
I mean, you have a long-standing rule. I mean, some form of this has been in place, my understanding is, since the 40s.
I know the rulemaking for this goes back to 1982.
And the 1982 rule, I believe, is very similar to the same rule that's been in place since, I think, 1947 or 48, something like that.
Correct. And the commission has consistently taken the position that while that rule can be applied to deadlines for filers, it cannot be applied to the commission's implicit statutory period to act on rehearings, act on rate filings, because that would impermissibly extend the burden, the waiting period imposed on utilities by Congress. And the commission's interpretation sort of tries to affect.
So is the statement in the petitioner's brief that the commission has repeatedly stated, including in the Federal Register, that this rule applies to this very time period?
Yes, the commission.
That's wrong?
The commission's emergency, yes, in the rulemakings.
No, yes, what? Yes, it's wrong?
No, yes, the commission has stated.
Yes, it's correct.
In those rulemakings that that it could be applied to their statutory timelines act. But in practice, they were talking about emergency situations in those rulemakings. In practice, the commission's consistent practice has been to act prior to the proposed effective date set by a utility when that proposed effective date is on a holiday or a weekend, to not take advantage of rule, to not apply rule 2007. And the distinction the commission's drawing is it's basically saying, look, in the Federal Power Act, Congress has imposed on aggrieved parties the obligation to seek rehearing within 30 days. If we're closed on the 30th day, if that happens to be a Sunday, we're going to extend the deadline because that satisfies, that gives effect to the intent of Congress of giving you 30 days to formulate your rehearing request. Conversely, the obligation imposed in Section 205D, they're not filing a rate proposal that the commission gets to vote up and down on, as the Supreme Court noted in the Mobile case, first half of Mobile Sierra. These are actual rate changes, and the notice period is just an embargo. So the commission is saying, Congress said you have to hold your rate changing authority on hold for 60 days, and we're going to keep it at 60 days. We're not going to take advantage of our regulatory rule to place a burden on you, utility, greater than what Congress did.
How would a party here know that this is what FERC would do in this context? I mean, if they were to look at our case law and to look at FERC's own regulations, how would a party be on notice that FERC was going to do what it did?
So, I want to make two points with respect to reliance. First, in this case, how would a party know?
Because deadlines need to be clear, right? We need to have a rule so people know what their obligations are.
And it's kind of dovetail with 825DG. The one thing that's clear in 825DG is that for purposes of rehearing, the commission's failure to act is the order. And on October 13th, the commission issued a notice and said our failure to act occurred on October 11th.
Two days afterwards.
Correct, but
so they've lost 2 days.
That's when the notice went out.
But they've lost 2 days.
But they were on notice, actual
notice. How are they on notice if they looked at 2007?
Well, first of all, I would like to just push back against the suggestion that's been made that they actually did rely on Section 207. Because if you look at the rehearing requests, which are at page 1100 and 1118 of the JA, what they sought rehearing of was not the commission's failure to act. They sought rehearing of the notice. They dubbed that the aggrieving order or the deadlock order. In fact, page 1102, the rehearing request specifically says, on October 13, 2021, the commission failed to act within the 60-day period set by Section 205. October 13th is the date of the notice. You can't reach that date using any calculation under 207 that they've posited thus far. They misread the statute and thought that the agreement order was the notice, when in fact it's the commission's failure to act. So I think the notion that there was actual reliance, and that explains why they filed on November 12th, because 30 days after October 13th is November 12th. So the notion that there was actual reliance on Rule 207, I think, is misplaced. But again, how could a party know? There was notice in this case that the failure to act, key clear trigger for rehearing under Section 824DG, occurred on October 11th. And, just also, how could this...
How could it occur on October 11th, though, which was Columbus Day?
Because the statute says utilities have to give at least 60 days notice. Here they chose October 12th as their proposed effective date. This court's decision in National Fuel Gas, I believe, says if you pick a effective date outside of the 60-day period further, the commission has within that period to to act. So the commission could have acted.
I'm sorry. Can I just go back to Judge Rao's very first question? I just don't understand. Rule 2007, it expressly applies to any time period that is prescribed or allowed by statute or regulation or commission order.
Well, I think the language of the rule itself, I believe, is any time period.
Yeah.
Well, I do grant you in the...
And we've held, right, in the city of Batavia that applies to the 30-day period, right?
Correct.
So it seems to me you're making this thing exceptionally complicated when the answer is really quite simple. It's just the plain language of the rule, 2007.
Well,
what am I missing?
Maybe I'm missing your question. The plain language of the rule applies to, I think it says any time period.
Yeah.
And the argument is, well, your section 205D, even though it's worded as a imposition, an embargo of the utility's rate change, that is in effect a time period for you to act respond to a rate filing.
Right.
And the commission's position is if 207 could be applied, if the language of 207 could be applied in this circumstance, it can't be because that would be overriding and improperly extending the notice obligation imposed on utility.
So shouldn't the commission amend its rule?
Well, I mean, that's a possibility, certainly. But the point is two. One, there is no evidence in the record of reliance on that rule. Two, parties were placed on notice that this is how we're calculating the date. And three, if it could be applied to this circumstance, if the language is broad enough to cover it, which admittedly it says any time period, that would be inappropriate to do it because it would conflict with the 60-day notice period in Section 205B. So the commission would be without power to extend the sort of the embargo on rate changes that Congress imposed under Section 205D.
Even though in every other statute that I'm aware of, the deadline imposed by Congress that falls is read extended.
Yes, because I think the language of Section 205, the precise language is important. It's not, yes, implicitly, if the commission wants to act on a rate filing, it needs to do so before the proposed effective date. But what Section 205 does is impose a notice obligation on the utilities. It says you make a rate change, it can't go into effect until there's been 60 days of notice. So it's really an obligation imposed upon them, a pause on their otherwise undisturbed rate making authority. And I think that's what differentiates it from deadlines you might see in court proceedings and the like.
Mr. Kennedy, if you could address the question I asked petitioners, which is, if this court were to find that FERC's rehearing, that the rehearing petition was in fact timely, why isn't the appropriate remedy to remand to FERC to consider the rehearing on the merits?
So I think that is the, as you noted, the sort of the standard procedure. What makes this case different, among many other things, is the fact that you have before you majority voted orders from the commission that deal with many of the same issues that were raised with respect to the agreement. So the court has before the commission's post-rehearing word on a lot of these issues that were raised in both cases. So as a practical matter, you have the commission's position on whether the tariff provisions are just and reasonable.
If we were to find the tariff provisions were just and reasonable, assuming that we found that, would there be no reason for a remand on the deadlock order rehearing?
Well,
resolve the issues? I mean, petitioners suggest that there are analytically different questions in the two orders.
And the commission did carve out, if you look at the tariff order, it deemed some issues as beyond the scope because they had been resolved by virtue of the agreement going into effect by operation of law. But I think the others, again, you have the commission's considered judgment on those questions. So they're analytically distinct in that they were addressed in two different dockets, but it's the precise same arguments that the participation requirements are unduly discriminatory. That's the same analysis whether they exist in the agreement or are conditioned to making use of the
Can you also say a little bit about why FERC believes that we have jurisdiction over the deadlock order? I mean, under the plain language of 205DG.
So I agree with you, Honor, that there, Your Honor, that 205DG, B, maybe 2B, anyway, the one, it funnels you, it assumes a world where there's a deadlock, rehearing, another deadlock, that's, and then it provides judicial review in those circumstances. I don't think it gets you there here because there is no deadlock, there's no subsequent deadlock with respect to.
I think the standard of review for whether we, if we had jurisdiction over a deadlock order, is very vexing. And I'm not sure that the statute here gives us any guidance that changes the reasoning of the public citizen case, and as I said, the two FCC cases that preceded that.
So, you know, listening to what you said before, I'll try to confine myself just to the language of the statute. I think if you look at section G1A, which talks about deadlock that gets you to rehearing. Obviously, it references section 825LA. In the Allegheny case, that this court describes section 825LA as establishing the precursors to judicial review. So I think there's some suggestion there that there would be review on the merits. And then if you had a subsequent deadlock on rehearing, again, section 825G2 references an appeal under section 825LB, which talks about the, which, you know, is a standard provision for judicial review under the Federal Power Act, where the court typically applies the arbitrary.
But the statute doesn't really tell us what we would review, which was the concern of this court in those other cases, right? So I know the commission takes the view that we should just look at, you know, we should look at the record as a whole.
Well,
our position, some very deferential standard.
Sorry, our position is a little more nuanced than that. One, what should be reviewed? I think what differentiates this case from some of the others is you have congressional language deeming the deadlock to be an order, both for purposes of rehearing and then essentially for judicial review if there's another deadlock. So I think that takes it, differentiates from the FEC cases. The implicit finding is not just an order, it's an order accepting the rate filing. So the implicit finding of that order is that the rate filing is just and reasonable. And our position
is... It's not a FERC finding. It is a congressional judgment that in a deadlocked case, such rate goes into effect. So what if Congress were to enact a statute that embodied the SEEM agreement, right? It says we approve the SEEM agreement. And they enact that into law, signed by the president. Could this court review that under arbitrary and capricious review?
No.
Could we decide whether Congress had behaved reasonably?
I
don't think that's how we review statutes.
No, correct. But again, you know, and obviously the intent of this was to have the court look at the, based on the legislative history, the intent was to have the court look at this.
Maybe. I think the legislative history is a bit murkier than some of the briefings suggest, but.
Well, in particular, if there's any question that I would direct your attention to, supplemental appendix page 4 and 5, Representative Kennedy's statement as to this, but I take your point. As to the standard review, we believe the agency action would be the congressionally directed acceptance of this, basically saying, you know, if it's 2-2 split, the two who voted in favor, who would have voted in favor of the rate change, they're the governing group. The implicit finding is that it's just and reasonable. Is there evidence in the record to assess whether that finding is arbitrary and capricious? And our position is that the commissioner's statements can be guideposts and anchor the court's review.
That's not FERC's position in its Third Circuit case. So why is FERC's position different here than in the Third Circuit? I mean, are these cases materially distinguishable? Because it seems that FERC is, I don't know, testing out different theories in different circuits.
Well, to be perfectly candid, we're trying to work our way through a statute that Congress has dropped in our lap and figured out the best way to apply. I believe our positions in both cases are in parallel. Again, in both cases, we're saying that on the merits review is appropriate. In both cases, we're saying the agency action for purposes of review is the congressionally directed acceptance. In both cases, we're saying the arbitrary and capricious standard of review is the appropriate standard. In both cases, we say the commissioner's statements can anchor the court's review. Where they differ, and I think it's a matter of context, in the Third Circuit case, the argument was, court, you can't look at anything. Similar to the, there's no agency action, therefore the statute requires an automatic remand. We argued no, and we said, look, these commissioner statements, they're there for a reason. Look at what we have. You can subject them to APA. You can subject them to APA review and looking at them. The question here is different. Must you? And our position here is that nothing in the language of Section 824EG requires or imposes all the requirements of the APA on those commissioners.
Well, how?
But
how?
The court can look.
No, I'm sorry. You finish your.
I'm done.
Oh, well, let me just pursue your line of questioning here with Judge Rao. So just take an example. Well, actually, it's not an example. It's this case. So the two commissioners, the two commissioners relied on record evidence, an expert, that that the SEAM agreement would yield, what, $40 million worth of benefits or something? A big number, right? And there's an affidavit in the record challenging that, saying the analysis is flawed and a proper cost-benefit analysis would come out the other way. Now, the two commissioners did not address the rebuttal evidence at all, right? Didn't say a word about it.
I just want to take one issue with one. Well, to immediately answer your question.
Well, let's stick with my question. So,
but
it's largely correct, isn't it, what I just said?
They did not mention, I would just say that they did note that there were evidence in the record of projected benefits, but they also said the benefits here are obvious and there's virtually no downside. So there was also quality.
Well, but they didn't, I mean, in a classic APA case, that would be we would vacate that. It would be a simple administrative law 101 vacate.
Well,
because the commission made a decision without explaining why contrary evidence didn't change the result. We would vacate that.
Well, I would take issue with that in this case because in addition to noting the projected benefits, they also took a qualitative view. If you look at the...
No, just stick with my point. Do you agree with me that in a regular APA case, that would be, we would vacate that decision and send it back for failure to consider the full record? And so my question to you is, what do we do with that? How do we evaluate that rebuttal evidence, that expert testimony, which challenged the benefits of the SEAM agreement? Do we just look at it ourselves and say, okay, yeah, we've read them both, and we think that the commission could have reasonably relied on the expert that it did? I mean, how do we do that? Usually we defer the commission on these things, but I just don't know what we would do with that in this case. Did you see my point?
I do.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you the direct answer to your last question.
Yeah.
Yes, but I do want to back up a bit. This is not a case where the commission or any of the commissioners looked at a benefits analysis and did a metric cost-benefit analysis. The commission explicitly made this point in the tariff orders that they looked generally at the qualitative benefits. But
I agree with that. But your point's well taken. But I don't think that changes the point I made. But you're right about that. But that doesn't in any way change my concern that the commission relied on a piece of evidence against which there was serious rebuttal evidence, which it didn't consider.
Well, I guess, and again, I don't want to fight your hypothetical too much.
That's not the hypothetical. I think it's this case.
No, I think it is a hypothetical because, the commissioners noted projected benefits, but they also found qualitatively, undeniably, this is going to be good news for consumers. We're bringing people to the market who think they can, rather than generate themselves and enrich their own generators, right, they can get it cheaper in the market.
I don't want to pursue this too far. But look, if the commission, let's make it really simple. If the commission says, if an expert says $40 million worth of benefits, right, and the commission relies on that, And there's a rebuttal affidavit which says that's wrong. It's not 40 million, it's zero. Doesn't make any difference what else the commission said about the decision, whether it relied on other evidence. It failed to consider a fundamental piece of evidence that is contrary to what it concluded, right?
So how we think it should work? Yes, that in that circumstance, yes.
Okay, but your point is this case, right?
A legitimate objection?
Yeah.
Yes, we would ask that if there's support in the record for not turning your, not reversing course based on that evidence, that would be something for the court to look at. And I know we're in an odd circumstance here, but I don't think it's that out of bounds.
It's the first time I've ever seen anything.
Section 706 explicitly says that in conducting arbitrary capricious review, the court can look at the record or the specific parts of the record pointed out by the parties.
Uh-huh.
Just for the record, we disagree with the characterization.
Let me just change the subject briefly, because we've been talking for a long time. Could you just state for us, step back and state for us, from the commission's point of view, what exact issues are before us on this part? What is the exact issue before us?
So whether with respect to the agreement,
I think
we have to divide it between the agreement. Yes. And the tariff.
Order. Okay, start with the agreement.
With respect to the agreement, is there support in the record being the commissioner's statements and the record, for a conclusion that acceptance of the agreement was not arbitrary?
What about the timeliness question? Don't we have to decide that first?
Yes.
Okay, so what's that? Start with that.
Whether the commission reasonably concluded that it could not use its regulation to extend the statutory notice period in Section 2.
Okay, and suppose we think the commission's wrong about that. Then then what do we do?
Well, again, the standard practice would be a remand, but again, this is not the standard case because you have the commission's post-rehearing word on a lot of these issues that are common to the two.
Uh-huh. Okay, so number one, if we think it's timely, then we go on and decide the merits of the challenge to the SEEM agreement, right?
You think the rehearing requests are timely? No. Then I think the standard practice would be to, like I said, to remand for consideration of the rehearing requests.
Wait, I thought you just said that they're related to each other. We should decide those questions. That's why I asked you to give me a summary here.
So,
I thought you were about to clarify this to me.
I apologize. That's what I'm going for.
Okay, try again.
So on the agreement side.
Yeah. Oh, let's start with the proposition. Let's assume we think that the petition was timely. Now what? Is that the end of the case?
So we would say no.
We would say what?
We would say no because the court has before it commission's final word in the distinct tariff proceeding on many of the same issues.
Okay, so then number two, then we would go on and decide the deadlock question and the standard of review, right?
No, I think what would make most sense in that circumstance is to remand to the commission those questions that were not resolved, that were not spoken to and resolved in the tariff proceeding.
What would we do with the SEEM agreement?
Well, we would suggest the appropriate court, if the court agrees that the petition's position that their request timely remanded, and we would suggest without vacater to the commission for consideration of the issues that were not fully addressed in the tariff proceedings. And the main one there, I think, probably is the mobile CRM.
What happened to SEEM in your analysis? Where does that go? That's what goes back to the commission to consider on the merits?
Consider the rehearing request on the merits, yes. As to those issues, we would say that, again, the court has before it the final resolution, the post-rehearing word from the commission on many of these issues that were raised.
So the SEEM agreement would still stay in effect while rehearing was pending, because it went into effect by operation of law.
We would think that would be the appropriate, we think that would be appropriate if the court were inclined to determine that it actually had jurisdiction to consider the claims with respect to the SEEM agreement. That rehearing was timely sought.
With respect to the tariff order, explain to me why this isn't a loose power. Why isn't this a multilateral agreement? Why isn't it either special or discounted when Order 888A seems to say that a non-pancake rate arrangement is by definition discounted?
Well, so what the commission explained here is that there's two pieces to the answer. Is it discounted or is it special? This is a unique or a new service, so it's not a discount of any existing service. So then you get to the question of whether it's special. And the commission interpreted special by looking to Order 888, which equated special in the same vein as favorable, not the alternative interpretation posited by petitioners, that should just mean unique. The commission looked at the language of 888 and said, no, it should be favorable. Looking at all the characteristics of this new transmission service, the $0 transmission service, it found that in balance, it wasn't favorable. Yes, it has some favorable characteristics. Obviously, it eliminates rate pancaking. But fundamentally, it's the lowest priority. It can't be used to satisfy your liability obligations. And fundamentally, you can't count it to be there when you need it. So on balance, it is not a special transmission service. And I think if you sort of step back and check that analysis with the general.
And why didn't they just write the order without the, with the regular pancakes?
I'm not sure I understand your.
I mean, why was the tariff written the way that it was?
With zero, with no charge transmission service?
Yeah.
Well, that's the goal, to take advantage of that unused transmission capacity, to impose no charge on it, to enhance these bilateral transactions between the parties at these sub-hourly rates. There is no.
But one could construct it with the normal transmission, right?
And I think, yes, you could impose transmission, but I think one of the reasons behind using this zero charge is that the transmission charges, the normal transmission charges, could be an impediment to fostering these sub-hourly trades. It can make them, people are only coming to the market. They don't have to. They're only coming to the market if it makes economic sense. If they can buy power and get it to where they need it, less than they can generate it and transmit it themselves. So by raising the cost of the transmission on these transactions, you take away the economic benefits and you may discourage them. So that's why it's written with no charge. And kind of look at Order 888 and the purpose of open access, yet you care about these loose power pools because you don't want to select a group of transmission providers to have preferred terms for themselves. And that's not the case here because everyone who can participate in the C market can access this transmission service at no charge.
Not everybody can participate in the C market, including like 65 participants who participate that bilaterally, right?
Right. That's the fundamental complaint one of the participation requirements is that you be a generator or sink demand load within the footprint of the market. And the commission found in the majority voted tariff orders, and Commissioner Christie noted this as well in his statement, that that's just a technological requirement. The short time span in which.
But it's a technological requirement developed by SEEM. It's not like some innate technological problem. It's a technological problem that, by its terms, results in the exclusion of what's the number you just
said? 65.
65 entities outside of SEEM.
It's not a problem created by them. They didn't.
Sure,
it's a function of the fact that where the market is located.
No. It's created by them by requiring by having the algorithm do trades at less than 20 minutes. Right. That's
the yes.
Okay. So it's a technical barrier created by SEEM. And there's nothing that I've seen that suggests why that was inherently necessary for the C market to operate.
Well, because the whole idea of the C market is to foster these sub-hourly trades where you can save a little money.
What's the magic of 20 minutes? What about 25 minutes?
Well, I'm not certain what. It's 15, first of all.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's 15. You're right.
I'm not aware of how long it would need to be to, for them to.
Well, without some explanation by that, then all we have is an arbitrary, at least on the record, the 15-minute requirement just seems. What it is it's exclusive. That's its impact.
Yes, it's a participation requirement.
Okay. Let me ask you a question about.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to. I just had one question to follow up on Judge Wilkins' question about PowerPool. The coalition cites, they cite a provision in Order 888, which gives non-pancake rates as an example of a discount. It's right in Order 888. And I didn't see, the commission didn't say anything about that. You didn't say anything about that in your brief.
Well, the commission found that this is not a discounted rate because it's a completely
because
new,
it's non-pan, right?
No, because it's a completely new service. It can't be a discount of an existing service. The example in 888 is, our firm transmission from A to B normally would have pancakes, but for you, we're gonna give you transmission service same.
I see. So your fundamental, your basic point is that it's
new.
It's so new. It's not discounted, and that's the end of the analysis. So,
No. The second part of the analysis is then whether that's the end. That's the end. Then you consider whether it's a special transmission arrangement. And the commission found, as I explained to Judge Wilkins, on balance, the fact that it was lowest priority meant that it was not favorable.
Did the commission ever say that that's the reason why 888 doesn't apply?
Yeah, the commission construed Order 888A, which talked mostly about these loose power pools. And just coming back to the point briefly, I know I'm way over time here, but the geographic limitation. The commission's role under the Federal Power Act is passive. It reviews things. Here, parties proposed a solution, an interstitial market that was going to benefit consumers. That is the main goal and its only aim. The fact that it could have been designed better, maybe they could have picked 25 minutes. The point was that what they proposed was just and reasonable. The fact that there's another solution out there that could have been more just and reasonable in the commission's determination didn't affect the analysis. Its role is to look at the proposal before it and assess whether that's just and reasonable.
Any other questions?
No.
No.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. And now we'll hear from intervener for respondents,
thank you,
Mr. Fitzgerald.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Matt Fitzgerald on behalf of the members of SEEM. SEEM was created to bring millions of dollars in consumer benefit across the Southeast region each year. And it's important to note that it is a residual market. It's existed now for several months, and in that time, never on any day has the power transacted through SEEM exceeded about 3% of the power used across this region. It is interruptible service of the lowest priority, and it works only when there is vacant transmission space available. Now, there's been some discussion of the cost-benefit analysis in particular by Judge Tatel. And I'd like to say the statements of Christie and Danley at page 64 and 97 of the joint appendix say there will be benefits to consumers. So they're looking at this $40 to $100 million analysis, and they're accepting that. And additionally, the expert from the coalition on the other side, there was a suggestion that he found there would be negative benefits or something like that. But actually, at page 819 of the joint appendix, he said, basically, I can't figure this out, and $40 to $100 million is an upper bound. So the comparison is it really 40 to 100 million, or is that an upper bound? And it's reasonable for Christie and Danley to have come to the place that there will be obvious benefits to consumers. Now, As for the multilateral sort of pool on the discounted service point, it's important to point out that even if you think this is a multilateral setup, even if you think it's discounted, there are only two places that that goes. There are only two reasons that that matters. One of them is that a joint tariff would be required, but we got a waiver of the joint tariff requirement at page 147 of the joint appendix in the tariff order. And the other is that it would require open access. And FERC concluded, again, by majority in the tariff order at page 147, that we are open access to the extent of technological feasibility.
And could you just explain that to us? That would be a big help if you could explain to us the 15-minute thing and why that's essential to this. Could you just step back and teach us about that? Okay.
Sure. So the way that the world works in the energy markets...
That's a great way to start an answer to the question, the way the world works.
It works day ahead and hourly. So transactions are done in the normal sense hourly. There are some sub-hourly, they're not common, and they're not ordinary regimes for them. The whole idea of SEEM is to squeeze out a little bit of benefit in a residual sense by allowing these intra-hour 15-minute transactions and by providing free transmission for that. So in theory, some of that could exist today, but the transactions do not occur because of the pancaking. It's uneconomic and it's not logistically possible to do these narrow time frame, to fit it in when, there's some transmission vacancy, we have a bid, we have an offer, boom, there's a deal and the power goes.
But wouldn't it be even more efficient and a better market if the entities that are outside of the SEEM territory could get they participate now, right? Before SEEM, they were doing trades. Wouldn't it be a better market if it were a bigger market, including them?
Your Honor, yes, and we are expanding SEEM all the time. We're already going into Florida. We have new members in Florida. So when we talk about this geographic limit, I want to be clear. Anyone who is any generator or SINC who is connected physically to the transmission system of any of our members, and we're expanding, looking for new members, can participate. So when the other side says, there's 65 trading partners excluded,
right?
I'd like to say first, that's basically just a citation to an unsupported assertion that they made below. In other words, we haven't seen a list of these 65 companies. But even if there were some trading partners under the existing regime excluded, my strong belief is that those are companies inside of neighboring RTOs. So there's a map at page 12 of FERC's brief. It's a map of the SEEM territory. But what it doesn't show is the borders of RTOs, which are to the north and to the west. Companies that are located inside of those RTOs are fundamentally positioned differently. RTOs don't have this free transmission. RTOs aren't set up for these 15-minute interstitial things, which is our whole idea here. And so to deal with them is just a categorical different bucket of fish. It is beyond what is currently technologically possible. One final point on...
I still don't... Just say one more thing about beyond technologically possible. Could those RTOs... Could they adjust somehow their system to accommodate the 15-minute algorithm?
Your Honor, whether they could do that would be up to, I think, not only companies inside of those RTOs, but the central command of those RTOs. And to be clear, we don't have a categorical opposition to that. It's the system we've created for the companies who are similarly situated, which doesn't at present go into those boundaries. It's just a different, whole categorical different issue to take this idea into an RTO versus not.
All right, thank you. That was helpful.
Mr. Fitzgerald, interveners don't challenge standing here for the petitioners, is that correct?
We don't, Your Honor, not in our brief, that's right.
Do you accept that that all of the petitioners here have standing?
I don't think it matters if all of them have standing, if any of them do.
Do you think there are some candidates that are more likely to have standing than others, some entities?
Yes, probably that's true. Yes, definitely. But I think it's important to note that there aren't any individual companies. When I look at the list of who's in the coalition, it seems like there are associations which are often made up of renewable energy producers. And I want to be clear that a renewable energy producer, that's a generator, who is physically connected to the transmission system of any of our members, is welcome to join. And once they join, they are subject to the exact same rules as any member. There is no disadvantage in the operation of this market or the rules as applied to any participant versus any.
But don't the utilities have veto power to keep them from becoming members or participants?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that's the allegation that's been made, and I don't think it makes sense. There is a committee that is made up of members, and the members, keep in mind, include the federal government, the Tennessee Valley Authority. It includes electric co-ops, which are just consumer-owned entities, and local and state governments. So I don't believe there is any power for who are the bad guys in their view, which is the big investor-owned utilities.
Does it take to keep anyone vote?
I'm sorry?
What is the voting requirement for to accept the new member, new participant?
So there is a committee which is made up of the members, and all that they do, my understanding, is accept when a new member satisfies the criteria, which is just being plugged into a member's system, making enabling agreements, which is agreements to sell power, which is what they all ought to be out there doing anyway, with at least three of us, and they sign agreeing to follow the rules of the system, then they come in. I don't believe anyone has been turned away. And we have been adding members.
But they don't have to, members don't have to sign the enabling.
Correct. So the enabling agreements are all bilateral agreements, one-on-one. Companies agree to deal with each other, and they have terms like credit terms. You know, one company agrees to deal with another company. They make an enabling agreement. If you have three, you need three enabling agreements at least, and to have at least three entities toggled on in order to bid or offer into the market once you're in. But the enabling agreements are just an ordinary feature of any bilateral market, which is the companies can deal with who they choose to deal with. And they're particularly important for us here because of TVA, which is subject to a completely Byzantine series of regulations about who it can sell power to and deal with, which comes straight from Congress. TVA, right at the core of our area, connects members to other members. It's important that we have a system that can bring them in. And a lot of what we've done here is to accommodate the TVA in that way.
I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Kennedy. So would you just tell us, you know, give us a decision tree. What issues do we have to decide in what order?
So, Your Honor, and there's...
From your perspective.
I'm sorry?
From your perspective, what are the issues this court has to decide? Do we start with timing, right?
You start with timing.
Okay. And suppose we think the petition's timely.
Okay. If you think that the petition is timely,
yeah,
then you are in a place where you are positioned to review the thing that led to the Seymour, the deadlock, if you will. So when you're positioned to review the deadlock,
right,
you have procedural options there. Perhaps you're not loving any of the procedural options, but what you do have there, and what's unusual and unique and helpful to you, is the tariff order. Because the tariff order is a majority order of the commission, and it specifically entertains, analyzes, and rejects every argument that petitioners are still making in this case, except Mobile Sierra. Uh-huh. So the tariff order solves the procedural review. So you review the tariff order.
So in other words, even if we thought that the deadlock order by itself would be a problem or would create a tricky standard of review issue that's solved by the existence of the tariff order, right?
Yes.
Except for Mobile Sierra. So what do we do with that?
Okay, so here's the thing about Mobile Sierra. The arguments that petitioners are actually making on appeal against Mobile Sierra are very broad, but Mobile Sierra has been cut back vastly since it was originally accepted by operation of law. There are only about 20 provisions left that are subject to Mobile Sierra in the agreement, and they are internal governance issues which are not of the sort that could plausibly hurt the public. So, for instance, what's still subject to Mobile Sierra? It's things like how the members divvy up costs among each other, how they deal with dispute resolution among each other, protections of the status of non-jurisdictional, non-FERC jurisdictional members. So there really isn't that. So the way you deal with Mobile Sierra is there is no place in the petitioner's briefs where they call out any specific provision still subject to Mobile Sierra and say how that poses a great danger to the public and should not possibly be within FERC's discretion to do.
Mr. Fitzgerald, it seems both the commission and the petitioners view the two orders, the SEEM agreement order, the deadlock order, and the tariff order as analytically distinct. But you seem to be suggesting that our review of the tariff order could inform our review of the deadlock order.
Definitely. And I think we're talking past each other a little bit because in some sense, they could be analytically distinct. So in other words, I think it's because petitioners' arguments here are all really attacks on the SEEM agreement that they blur together. So in other words, even if, let's say the deadlock or appeal were untimely, so you're setting aside the deadlock order, you're just looking at the tariff order. Petitioners could appeal the tariff order standing alone if they said the tariff order does not faithfully implement the SEEM agreement. That would be a standalone way. That's really what the tariff order is doing. It's accepting changes to the tariffs to implement SEEM. But because what petitioners have chosen to do is attack the SEEM agreement, all their arguments, even the ones that say they're against the tariff order, are problems with the SEEM agreement. That's what brings them together, and that's why, and I think this is supposition, but I think the commissioners may have been trying to help this court when in the tariff order they realized, well, there, once you set aside Mobile Sierra, there are a majority of us who disagree with everything petitioners say about the SEEM agreement. And so they wrote it all down and put it in an order for you. And so the connection between the two is based on the fact that all of petitioners' arguments are really about the SEEM agreement. So that's how it helped. If you come to a place where you are reviewing whatever created the SEEM agreement, which I agree is an act of Congress and not an act of FERC, but if for some reason you need to review the deadlock, the tariff order helps you, and that's why.
How is that consistent with Chenery?
It's consistent with Chenery because it's not an act of FERC that accepted the deadlock order. It's not an agency action finding or conclusion. And so it would be impossible for the agency ever to provide you an adequate rationale as an agency in the event of a deadlock. And I think it's important to note, too, that FERC has done everything here that the law requires of FERC. And frankly, so we as the entities trying to propose a new rate. You know, normally when you entertain reversal or remand of something FERC has done, you identify it's done something wrong or something it's failed to do that it's obligated to do. But there's nothing like that in this case. The law says, I mean, clearly the commissioners are entitled to vote however they feel and what they think. The law says when you do that, you each write a statement. It's obvious they've each written a statement. They've each written a statement that clearly grapples with issues and considers it. We think the statements are good. But regardless of what you think, they're obviously good faith statements addressing the substance. And so FERC has done everything that it's supposed to do. There may be nothing to remand in this case.
I don't understand your legal position in that you say, well, maybe it's the commission's brief that words it this way, but
you say that the commission statements are a starting point for review, but you review the whole record. And so if the statements you find don't really respond to all the arguments made by the petitioners, it doesn't matter. We're supposed to be able to, as long as we can find evidence in the record to support, and any reasonable commissioner could conclude, could have voted to approve this, then that's what we should be doing. Cite me a case for in support of doing performing our review.
Your Honor, the closest thing to a case in support of that are probably the FEC cases, where it is clear that this court does and can look into the record beyond the statements of individual commissioners in those cases. I think that's mentioned in
those cases. Aren't those cases in which the statements are joint?
I believe in those cases they are joint statements.
Right, whereas yes. Here they're not.
Here they're not.
Does that make a difference?
I don't think as a matter of law that it makes a difference. I think when commissioners have gotten together in a joint statement, then perhaps you can squint and call that and review that thing like an order slightly more reasonably, but I don't think it actually solves the problem.
Mm-hmm.
No. So just one final point on the big picture order 888. A lot of petitioners' arguments center around supposed problems with Order 888. But here's the thing. Order 888 goes back to 1996. The point of it was that FERC did not want utilities favoring their own expensive generation over cheaper alternatives. Well, SEEM exists and is created specifically to facilitate bringing cheaper power to consumers. That's what it does.
The other part of it is it didn't want them disfavoring others, competitors, by restricting access to transmission. That's just as important.
Yes, and the finding of FERC, which is again in the tariff order at page 144 and 145, is that we are open access to the extent of technological feasibility. These borders that they complain about are categorically different in terms of what the technology allows. We find a way to save consumers millions of dollars by inventing this system that functions to this extent. And again, we're open to expansion and expanding all the time.
Any other questions, Judge Rao?
Yeah.
Judge Tatel?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel for petitioners, Ms. Fidler, we'll give you 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. In rebuttal, I just want to note that with regard to timeliness and 205G, just a couple of quick points, because I think the merits here are really the most important aspect of why this should be reviewed on the tariff order. And that is because, just as a procedural note, if this goes back solely to look at the SEEM agreement, because the commission is back to a 2-2 split, it's very likely that there will be another deadlock back here. And in the meantime, that could come back here for review. And in the meantime, the injury that is happening now continues. And that gets to the merits here with regard to assertions that SEEM is not a power pool. Order 888A explicitly states that a loose pool is a multilateral agreement that explicitly or implicitly contains discounted or special transmission. And counsel for the agency has stated that this isn't special or discounted because there are some terms that aren't fully favorable. But everybody has seen at some point a special offer today only. You can get a discount even if every element isn't particularly Perfect. And there's nothing in Order 888 excluding non-firm service from that.
Well, their point is that it's not a discount because it's a new service.
And that...
Is that wrong?
That is wrong, Your Honor. Explicitly, non-firm service is covered under 888A, 1213 states agreements restricting non-firm transmissions.
So, but this is a different non-firm service.
Right, but the...
That's their point. It's a different non-firm service. It's...
Right, but there's no...
So there's no discount because it's just new. It's different.
But there's no language in Order 888 stating that it doesn't apply to a new service. And if there were, then any new service would be excluded from Order 888's purview by simply saying, well, this isn't a discount of the existing service. This is a new service offered at a discount. It's obviously favorable, and it doesn't have to be both discounted and special.
How can it be? I can understand how it's a discount to... How can it be? You may be right. I just don't get why it's a discount if it's new. You can't... If I buy a product, a different product,
and
that product is discounted, is that a discount? Isn't it just me buying a new service?
Your Honor...
discounted to who? Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
No, Your Honor, and I want to understand your question. I think it's also important to recognize that it need only be special or discounted. And in this case, the special service is the fact that it's distinguishable from the norm. It's a different kind of service. And in this case, it's also a new service. So it doesn't have to be both special and discounted. Although the language that non-pancake rates are specifically considered a discount would
special does suggest there's something beneficial to it. I mean, here we're just talking about a residual product. It's not some entirely new thing. It's just some residual energy production that is being sold at a zero cost or being, you know, provided at zero cost.
Sure, but it's a service that's still of benefit to the users. I mean, that is residual is not a basis for non-application of Order 888, which explicitly does cover non-firm service. This is still a favorable product, and obviously the commission and the utilities have said as much repeatedly that this would offer benefits. So it doesn't make sense to say that it's both offering all these benefits and then say that it isn't beneficial, which is one of the inherently contradictory statements here. Further, it's important to address the preferred terms about everyone being able to participate. That's factually incorrect. It's not just a geographic exclusion. Within the footprint, certain types of entities who are not a source or a sink, and we have testimony from in the standing affidavits that they're producers who have distributed energy resources and demand response services within the footprint do not qualify as a source or sink. So even though they can participate in the bilateral market, they can't participate in this one. And then with regard to the independent power producers who are there, the fact that the agreement has all of these elements, the enabling agreements, the participant agreements, and then the use of the constraints and a toggle, those are all discretionary. Other short-term balancing type or explicitly balancing agreements have mandatory participant agreements and mandatory enabling agreements. And that could have been done here, and it isn't. And that is really the crux of part of the reason that the petitioner's expert was unable to put the bounds on like what the downside of this could be is because market power could be exercised through these various terms that are unfettered. So the extent to which the harm would go would be unknowable because that information is not made available to the participants.
Now the agreement's been in place for several months. So what harm has resulted?
Well, Your Honor, obviously that's outside of the record. So
unknowable.
We know that there are no independent power producers who have joined SEEM as had been predicted. And second of all, we know that the trades at this point are limited, therefore, between the big utilities. So the folks who are getting the benefits are the large utilities that were the focus of Order 888 to begin with. And this wasn't supposed to be, this is not about intent. Order 888 isn't about the extent of harm. That case-by-case analysis of what's the harm here and what's the harm here, that was the purpose of Order 888, where the commission had found that as profit-maximizing firms, monopoly utilities would have and will continue to exercise their market power in order to maintain and increase market share, and thus deny their wholesale customers access to competitively priced electric generation, and that these unduly discriminatory practices will deny consumers the substantial benefits of lower electricity prices. That comes from Order 888, that comes from this court's holding in Transmission Access Policy Study Group, and recently in Xcel Energy Services and ACP versus FERC. These cases all reiterate that this is fundamental economics. This isn't this, how much harm is happening here or the intent of the parties here. This is why we have Order 888 and why the provisions are expressed and to be applied on their face and not on the case-by-case analysis.
One question here before you sit down is, what's your response to the argument that we can look at the tariff order to help us review the deadline?
Well, Your Honors, I think one of the guiding factors is looking at Kansas City's FERC and cities of Batavia. It's normal for a big market to have several orders, several filings that effectuate putting a market into place. And that in both the cities of Batavia and Kansas City's FERC, the court decided the merits of the second order, even though it did imply terms that had been decided in the earlier matters. And I think, as I said, because the commission is once again at a 2-2, and like...
Well, so wait, excuse me. So you agree with Mr. Fitzgerald then, that we don't need to struggle with this issue about what to do with the deadlocked order and how to review it, because we have the whole record. We have the commission's decision on the tariff.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So
you agree with... Okay.
Let me mm-hmm. clarify. You're saying that it is appropriate for us to see, to look at the justifications in favor of the tariff, to see whether the deadlock was sufficiently explained or reasoned.
Yes, Your Honor. And as I understand that, I think that's everybody's position in terms of what's before.
All right. Any other questions?
No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.